Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Syrian civil war continues nearly into its third year now, and the human toll in this conflict continues unabated. And for the journalists who have tried to cover it, they've not been spared either. The Center for Media Freedom has documented 110 professional and citizen journalist deaths since the uprising began. Some agencies believe that number to be as high as 150 or more. Today, we hear the story about one of that number. Marie Colvin was considered by some to be the best war correspondent of her generation. She was flamboyant, wearing pearls gifted to her by Yasser Arafat, and sporting a black eye patch. That came from a grenade attack in the Sri Lankan Civil War. She was utterly fearless. She covered conflicts in Chechnya, Kosovo, Sierra Leone, Zimbabwe, and East Timor. There she is estimated to have saved 1,500 women and children in a compound through her reporting during a siege, which was lifted after 4 days. She also reported on Iraq, Libya, and Syria with my guest today, British war photographer Paul Conroy. Together, they entered Syria in March 2012, their second trip there, and found their way to Homs, a rebel-held city under siege for rebel and civilian alike. As the siege became stronger, they did some remarkable reporting on the civilian atrocities there, but most journalists left the city, but they decided to stay with tragic consequences. When a barrage of artillery fire came, Marie Colvin was killed instantly, and Paul was badly injured. Eventually, he made his way back to Lebanon, and he's written a book of his experiences and his remembrances of Marie Colvin. Paul Conroy's book is titled Under the Wire, Marie Colvin's Final Assignment. He joins us today from a London exhibition of his photographs of Syrian refugees, a fundraiser for the International Red Cross. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Paul Conroy, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, real pleasure. Thanks for having us on, Rich.
This book details a wonderful friendship, a comradeship under fire, and a very harrowing experience, and one that unfortunately has been one of the most dangerous journalists I've ever undertook, which is to go into Syria during this ongoing Syrian civil war. And in the course of the book, you tell of your own experiences, but also of your colleague, Marie Colvin. Tell us a little bit about Marie Colvin.
Marie was one of the most larger-than-life characters I've ever met, let alone worked with. I first bumped into her, I was in northern Syria about 13 years ago, when I'd unsuccessfully built a boat and tried to sail into Iraq to cover the conflict there. Marie heard of this story, and I'd never met her, and then one day the bar door burst open, and in strides Marie with her eye patch on, leather jacket, and just comes walking straight up, and she goes, "Are you the boatman?" And I was like, "Yep." And she just stuck her hand out and said, "Marie Colvin, you know, nice to meet you." And that was it, really. She was, that's when our friendship was born. We sat down, had a few whiskies, and she was just, you know, one of the bravest, most tenacious, thorough journalists I'd ever met, but also with a fantastic sense of humor and, you know, a true sense of the ridiculous and bizarre as well. You know, many of the occasions we found ourselves in, I think, lesser people than Marie may have balked and run 1,000 miles the other way, but she never did. You know, she was just a complete pleasure to know as a friend and to work with. You know, greatest working experience of my life.
Tell us about how you first met Marie Colvin. I believe it was in during the Second Gulf War. You were in Syria, actually trying to get into Iraq for the final assault on Baghdad. And the Syrian authorities wouldn't let you into Iraq. And it was like a sort of this tedium week after week. And you guys are all in a stupor. And she walks in. And what does she say?
She came in and all of the journalists were just laying about. It looked like a methadone rehabilitation clinic. Everyone was down and out. And she just came in, opened the door. In one feline glance from left to right, she just looked and she goes, "My God, they're drugging the effing journalists." Turned round and walk out. And that was the first time I'd ever seen her. And I never saw her again until I'd done my boat building activity. And that's when she introduced herself. So it was a great moment.
And that was your first connection, was the fact that she loved sailing and that sort of idea of skirting authorities, building your own boat, and trying to sail into Iraq, was sort of her ideal way of entering a war zone in many senses.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, she said, "Oh, my God," she said, "I love the boat idea." She said, "I was going to want to sail from, I think it was Lebanon into Gaza what's something bizarre in the little rented dinghy? So she loved that angle, you know, she loved the sense that, you know, someone had shown some initiative, and tie that up with a sailing exploit, and it just hit the nail. And I think that was the real foundation of our friendship, you know, that the silliness of it, but the actual, like, you know, I'm not waiting for the authorities, we're just going in anyway. And that was very much, you know, a theme through our careers together.
And a lot of that career was spent during the Arab Spring and the Arab uprising around the Horn of the Mediterranean. And 2011 found you in Libya.
In Libya, yeah. That's right. I got a call from the Sunday Times saying, Paul, do you want to get together with Marie and go into Libya? And it was like, absolutely. So we met in Egypt, in a hotel in Egypt, and I got in, had a cup of coffee, and we were literally off towards Libya across the desert. I think it was a 12-hour drive or something. We got into Libya, to Benghazi, where the fighting had very much moved on to a town called Misrata, which was heavily under siege. And the only way into Misrata was by ship. All our land routes were completely untenable. So we actually kind of stowed away. It goes back to the sea again. There was a ferry going, an office of immigration to try and rescue some refugees. So we sneaked on, only planning to go for 2 days. And I think we left Misrata approximately 2 months later. We took no clothes, nothing other than notepads, cameras and satellites. And we got there and we both agreed. Yeah, I mean, the place was under dreadful siege. Gaddafi's forces were in tanks on the high streets. They were shelling the areas constantly. And I think there was myself, Marie, Martin Shivers from the New York Times, and Brian Denton were the only journalists in Misrata for quite some time, really, while they fought hand by hand, door by door, and pushed Gaddafi's troops out of the city. But Marie, at no point did Marie consider leaving, or this was not a good idea. It was just, we're here, we'll do the job, we stay. And that was the beauty of working with her. You know, she would see things out to the very end.
And what was very interesting about the way she worked, it was not so much the battle, it was the effect of war on civilians. And that's what the two of you focused on, she as writer, you as a photojournalist.
Well, that's right. I mean, the phrase most associated with Marie is bearing witness. And that's really what it's about. There are many people who cover war from the different levels, from the geopolitical level, the larger scale. But war always has its most traumatic and awful effects on the ground. The people who are caught up in it, not the people who start it or fight it. It is the civilians, the women, the children who bear the brunt of these. And to tell the true story of war and the effects of war, you have to be there with them people. You can't do it from a long distance. You know, to understand the real trauma and to portray to the world the horrors of war, you've got to be with the people who suffer it most, and they are the people without a voice, without a way of speaking to the world or showing the world their stories. And that involves, you know, getting very often to the worst part of war, and that's where the bombs and shells are actually landing.
And unfortunately, the forces that are in conflict have begun to understand that better. And the best way to keep a lid on what's happening in the war is to target journalists.
Yeah, I mean, you've hit it on the head. I think, you know, as communications and technology has enabled us to do our job in the sense that we can get information out more easily. You know, information is as much part of war as our bombs and bullets. You know, the information has such a big effect on it. And the people who wage these wars realize that if you can cut off the information flow and stop them stories getting out, you can almost act any way you please. There's going to be no condemnation if there's no witnesses and no stories coming out. So, yeah, it's a relatively new phenomenon that journalists are now targets. In the old days, we kind of write press on all our vehicles, and that's something that we would not do anymore. It's like painting a target on your vehicle now.
Now, in Libya, that was such a disjunct war. You know, the forces were so sporadic and unorganized in many cases that journalists were somewhat safer in Libya. But from everything I hear, journalists in Syria, this has been the worst war where the Syrian military has actively targeted journalists as a way of basically shutting down coverage of what's actually happening in Syria.
Yeah, I mean, they have. Before we went in, we were told by contacting Lebanese military intelligence that any journalists found in the region of Homs, where we were headed to, were to be executed immediately and their bodies were to be thrown onto a battlefield, essentially, say, caught in crossfire. And this is, you know, a tale that has run right through for international press and for local Syrian journalists. You know, we knew one guy who took some photographs. The next day, he was delivered back to his house with his eyes gouged out. Yeah. As a warning, you know, you do not take photographs, you do not make reports on Skype or YouTube. And they've systematically targeted, you know, domestic journalists and international journalists. The amount missing at the moment is phenomenal, and they keep a blackout on it for security reasons. But I can't think of another war that I've covered where we were so directly targeted, you know, where the regime have actually just rather unashamedly killed journalists to stop them telling their stories.
In fact, over 100 journalists, both professional and civilian journalists, citizen journalists, if you will, have been killed in this conflict.
Yeah, you don't see numbers like that, you know, until you start going back to World War II. You know, they really are astonishing numbers. And it continues. I mean, the information supply coming out of Syria now is drying up as they've systematically, you know, they break networks, they'll catch someone with a laptop, they'll hack it, they'll find all their contacts. And they will go out and they will take all of their contacts, regardless as to whether they're journalists or not. They're so well versed in the art of suppression that they will just remove people. If your name shows up on a journalist's phone, then it's goodbye for you. They're quite ruthless. And you know, the great danger is that reports do stop coming out and the regime are free to carry on the regime of murder and torture, as well as slaughter of civilians.
Well, when you decided to go back with Marie for the Sunday Times in February 2012, you'd actually been in Syria once before, and sounds like from the way you wrote it, you said, wow, this is different. Was it evidently different from your very first trip into to Syria?
Yeah, I mean, the reality of Syria was, I mean, if you compared it to Libya, which was our last big experience, and once we got into Libya, we were in what would be called rebel-held territory. You knew that you could move around and talk to people. When you enter Syria, and especially Bab al-Amna, there is no rebel-held territory. There is no way back. We went in illegally at night through minefields on motorbikes with people we'd never met. And you're just within, you know, you're within Assad's forces area. We were never more than, I'd say, you know, 500 meters, a kilometer from Assad forces when we were in Syria. And it took us nearly 5 days to cross 30 kilometers of territory because it was so dangerous just to move, let alone get a camera out and operate. It was just the most oppressive situation to be in. You didn't know what was around the next corner, and they could be up on you any minute. So I've never really worked in that kind of situation in the past. In the Balkans, for example, 15, 20 years ago, we could get round with a bottle of scotch and 200 cigarettes and bribe a border guard or a patrol to let us through. And that's the way we operated. Now, in Syria, you know, you'd be crazy to show your face, to be honest.
Right. And you detail the whole trip, or this last trip in February of 2012, which starts in Lebanon. You contact some shadowy figures. Some are smugglers. Some are actually rebels moving back and forth between Lebanon and Syria. But basically, in this case, you knew a few of the people from your previous journey in. Marie did not, and was really depending on you to know, say, okay, this is a person I know. This is a person we can trust. But that whole idea of just putting your life into people you don't know who could betray you in a moment's notice, who could actually not be who they say they are. That is an amazing leap of faith.
It is. That's the thing that I think I wrote in the book on the plane on the way out to Lebanon. I was thinking, you know, within a week or two, I'm going to be completely putting myself at someone's mercy. And that's what it is. And most of these rendezvous, you're with somebody, and you'll stop, and another car will pull up, and you'll just get in that car quickly. And that's a huge leap of faith, and you have to evaluate and ascertain, you know, just glean what information you can by their mannerisms, their body language. You know, you will look for any clue possible to see if you've just made the right move or the move that is going to lead you somewhere very bad. As we got into city, we got slightly more confident because we'd stay for half a day at a house and, you know, watch the people's faces as they came in and out and just try and get a feeling for, you know, whether the next move was going to be the correct move. But as you say, it is an incredible leap of faith, and thankfully, you know, as far as that went, we were okay. We found ourselves with a good group of people who really, really looked after us on the way in.
And that's really impressive too. The fact that here they are, they're fighting in a situation where, you know, it could be every man for himself, and they're looking out for the people they charged in to tell the story, if you will. And were you able to tell the story? I mean, this is the whole thing. It seemed like everything in Syria was so combat front line that did you have time to be able to tell the stories?
Somehow we made the time. I mean, it was really, once we got into Baba Amra, we headed for the field hospital where we knew that that's where the stories would be, because people were being dragged there. You know, the only, it was a room really with a couple of, a doctor, a vet and a dentist who were working under the most intolerable circumstances. And that's where the studies came to. So it was also the main center, the main target in Baba Amra, because any medical setup in Syria was a target. So we went to the hottest zone to find the people with the stories, and that's really was our base of getting stories. And of course, we had to beware the fact that we were being sheltered and fed by the Free Syrian Army, that every story we were told, we had to double check and triple check, which involved lots of you know, crazy car drives and running, dodging snipers. So it was really, it was a very tough, tough place to work, in the sense that the moment you left a building, you know, the place was ringed with snipers. So you'd leave the building and they, you know, exploding bullets would just appear all around you. Then mortars would land. You get into a car, which were getting very scarce. I think there were two left at one point, and within a day or two, they were destroyed. So everything was then on foot. But we just eked out these stories, and eventually we came to a place called the Widow's Basement, which was one of the only cellars of any sort in Baba Amra, and it was just full to bursting of women and children who were the who'd lost their men. Their husbands and sons had all died. And so this was the final place that these people had. But there was nothing there. There was no food. The water was going. And it was truly a medieval. It was like operating within a medieval siege with modern, very high-tech and modern weapons. A horrible combination of trying to starve people out, deny people who were blown up any medical treatment, and at the same time continued and sustained assault on civilians.
And I think both of you felt, and you guys have covered conflicts from the Balkans, Iraq, Congo, Rwanda, in the case of Marie, Chechnya, Sri Lanka, where she lost her eye. You had both been veteran combat journalists. This was the worst. This is the worst you'd ever seen as far as the deliberate targeting of innocents, civilians, anybody, indiscriminate.
Absolutely. I mean, Marie and I looked at each other within about, I think, an hour of being there. We read each other's minds, and I said, you know, this is the worst. And she said, I agree. You know, she said, this is worse than Chechnya. And I could think of no... We really thought what we'd seen in Misrata and Libya, the siege of that town and the bombardment, then we said, this is the worst we'd seen. But Baba Amra just was beyond anything we recognized. It was... You know, it was almost that there was no war. It was just this circled neighborhood just getting pummeled. They were just raising it to the ground in the hope that they crushed Baba Amra. Then they essentially thought they were crushing the heart of the revolution. So there was very few, if any, military targets. It was being protected by a ragtag bunch of guys with Kalashnikovs against a full division of Bashar al-Assad's elite troops. These weren't just conscripts. These were actually professional soldiers. And neither of us had seen anything like it. We couldn't conceive it. It was times 30, 40 shells a minute landing in the area we were directly in, and that was replicated over the whole neighbourhood. It was unrelenting. Rain, walls of steel just falling on a defenceless neighbourhood.
Mm. And on February 22nd, Marie made a broadcast as she appeared via satellite phone to a number of major journalistic organizations describing the things you've been speaking about. And that probably led to your severe injuries and her death. She used a satellite phone, and I think it's the thought of most that perhaps the Syrian army were able to triangulate that satellite phone, perhaps, and they targeted the two of you.
Yeah, I would say without doubt that was the case. The reason we did it and how it came about is it was a Tuesday, and we were in the media center with a lot of the local Syrian citizen journalists, etc. There were rockets ripping houses apart, 20 feet down the road, and mortars, everything was landing. And we both came to the conclusion on the Tuesday night that we were never going to live to file the story on Friday for the Sunday paper. So we consulted with the locals who ran the media center and the journalists there, and they said, we said, can we transmit? Yeah, we was actually using their satellite system. We said, can we do this? And they said, you've got to do this. This isn't a choice. They said, we're all going to be dead soon. You guys are here. That's what we're here for. You must transmit. So it was a mutually agreed thing between Marie and I and the local journalists who were in that same situation. So we transmitted, I think it was three transmissions for Channel 4, CNN, BBC. And we finished at midnight because of the time differences. By 7:30 the next morning, the house was essentially removed from the map by four rockets fired. That could only have come from government forces. It was definitely, I think we'd rattled a few too many cages in Damascus, and the order was given, take them out.
And in fact, Marie died. Also, a French photojournalist died. You were severely wounded, a horrible thigh injury, which I think you've had, 10 to 12 operations on it since?
I think 19 was the last 19. Count. It got ridiculous. Yes.
And you had to get out of there. In fact, you talked about how there was a veterinarian in the medical clinic. I think a vet treated you while you were still in Syria. Basically smuggled out again the same way you were smuggled in. And what I found really interesting was once you were back in Lebanon, you were not considered safe there. We've always heard about the porous border between Syria and how Syria dominates Lebanese politics, but the thought was, is if they really wanted you, they would get you in Lebanon.
That's sovereignty, right. Yeah.
Be damned.
Yep, they really would. We were told by the British, the ambassador there, he said, you can't go to hospital. And I was like, well, why not? And he said, well, we've got intelligence that says that our death squad's going around the hospitals as we speak looking for you. So I was kept inside the ambassador's house with under armed guards because they just said, you cannot go out there. They wouldn't countenance me going near a hospital because they knew they were looking. Beirut is full of Damascus's people. So the situation was bad. Even in Lebanon, it wasn't over till they actually got me on a plane and out of there. And when I got back to the UK, I was my location had to be kept secret and quiet because even then they suspected that it wouldn't be beyond the reach of the regime to strike out at me in London.
Why would they still strike out at you once you'd left your reporting position? Was it the fact that you were shedding light on what was, an indiscriminate massacre of a city?
Yeah, I think that really was the case. At that point in Homs and Babar Amra, I think we saw what they were actually doing, and that is something they didn't want out. I think everybody knew it was happening, but the detail we saw and the level of it was something they just did not want the world to know of. And so I was quite consciously when I came out, I was an absolute a nightmare for the Syrians, because I just would not shut up about what we'd seen and what had happened. And I think even now they're still, you know, because I do so much work for them, I'll sit on panels, I'll discuss Syria on any event I can. And I really think it became kind of personal, really. Apparently they bought $1 million each on our survivors' heads, dead or alive, for the ones who got out of Baba Amra. And I think that's how personal it got. The fact that they didn't get their own way by killing us all in one go.
Well, the last words of your book is, at the time of the writing, President Bashar al-Assad remains in power. His army continues to wreak havoc, mayhem, and murder on his own people. And the pictures of massacred men, women, and children have now become routine images on our screen. In the 2 years since the beginning of the carnage, no nation has offered protection to the people of Syria. What is your hope from writing this book and telling the story and continuing to talk about what you've experienced in Syria, about a story that is very difficult to report, very difficult to see until the aftermath of the situation? And, of course, as you write in the book, Marie Colvin, his death, according to the Syrian authorities, was that she was killed by an improvised bomb set by terrorists. And it's that sort of black is white, night is day sort of situation. What is your hope in writing the book?
When Marie was killed, I know it created, the loss of some of these so high profile created a window, really, to tell that story. And while people were watching, I knew I had a certain amount of time that people would be interested. So I want to tell the world about what was happening in Syria as a very personal level, rather than a geopolitical level. Tell the story of one of the bravest people I've ever met who died, telling the story in the hope that it could make it all a bit more real and digestible than the mass coverage that we see. It's easy to be desensitized and lose track of the fact that these are people. And I think by telling Marie's story in conjunction with what we saw in Baba Amra, I just think, as me and Marie always were together, that to take it down to a very personal tale, a very personal level, that maybe people would be, more be able to take that in, and to not shut up, really, as not to let a sleeping dog lie, because it's still going on, as we know. Nothing's changed. You know, there still hasn't been a finger raised to defend any of them people. And, the book has given me a platform to keep reminding people that it's not over, it's still happening. And, we shouldn't lose fact of that it's an ongoing situation.
Well, Paul Conroy, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having us on.
Paul Conroy is our guest. He's the author of Under the Wire, Marie Colvin's Final Assignment. The British war photographer spoke with us from a London exhibition of his photographs of Syrian refugees. His book is published by Weinstein Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.